We also come from a very superstitious culture, right? So it's like, if you celebrate too quickly, it's like that might impact the outcome. Exactly.
Yeah. Oh my God.
Right.
Yeah.
We all have been there, like Gandhi Neza, right? Like we all know this. And so that impacts, if you think about it, it does impact our inability to celebrate. Because we were told, don't celebrate too quickly. You haven't finished your...
It'll be taken away from you.
Exactly. Yeah. So if you think about that, that's embedded in our DNA. And so, of course, it's going to impact our inability to be able to celebrate small wins.
That's deep.
Yeah.
I love that you just mentioned Nuzzer. I love
yeah.
that.
Yeah. Well, it's funny.
There's like a deeper meaning behind all of this. Like it's how you were raised, what you were taught, what you were conditioned to believe.
This is the Desi Condition.
Hello, Bondus. Welcome back to another episode of the Desi Condition. My name is Thanushree. I'm the host and creator of this space. And today we're covering, to put very generally, basically human behavior in the workplace and everything that comes with it, especially for South Asian and Asian women. I have my trusty co-host with me today, Anu. Anu, I mean, you know that I'm just a high school math teacher, but you did your master's in this, right?
No pressure. Yeah, I did do my master's in this. I am super excited to be interviewing Neelu Kaur, who we will be introducing in just a minute or two. But before we dive into this episode, I did want to take some time to define what organizational psychology is. What is it exactly? Before I got into the field, I thought it was just a fancy term for human resources, but it's actually way more than that. It is a study of human behavior in the workplace, as you mentioned, and it focuses on evaluating individual, group, and organizational dynamics and using research to identify solutions to problems that improve the well-being and performance of organizations and their employees. So it's a very diverse field. I've spent the past 5 years of my life trying to navigate it, trying to help people perform better, to feel better in the workplace, and to also work together. So I've worked in talent development, talent management, recruitment, and selection, as well as diversity, equity, and inclusion and belonging, which has been a really big, just a really big concept that has come up in the last couple of years. And we'll talk about that a little bit more, and more specifically for South Asian women and Asian women in the workplace in particular. But I hope that that helps some of our listeners understand what it is that we're going to be talking about.
Like Anu mentioned, our special guest today is Neelu Kaur, who has spent years coaching individuals on the intersection of leadership, wellness, particularly, like I said, with the focus on Asian and South Asian women, just helping them to be successful in their jobs, in their careers, in their mental well-being, and in the individuals that they manage. Neelu also recently authored the book Be Your Own Cheerleader in January of 2023, so very recently. And she discusses in the book techniques on self-advocacy and leadership. Neelu has a bachelor's from NYU Stern and a master's in social and organizational psychology from Columbia. And she is also a neuro-linguistic programming coach, which is also a very cool term that I don't know too much about. I don't know anything about anything. Like, give me like a calculus problem. I'll be good. So I'm here to learn too. And Neelu, thank you so much for joining us today. And we're so excited to have you. And is there anything that I missed in my introduction of you that you feel is vital for this conversation?
No, I think that's great. And I'm really excited to be here too.
So Neelu, we want to start with your origin story in regards to how you got into this work. What were some of the healthy or unhealthy beliefs and behaviors around self-promotion and advocacy that you observed that were modeled to you when growing up as a South Asian woman in this country?
I'm sure all of us can relate to this, but my parents, specifically because I was born in India and raised in the US. So when my parents came here, the philosophy was keep your head down, don't stand out, don't stick out. This isn't our country. Really just like your work will speak for itself. And that is a recipe for disaster in corporate America. I found out the hard way because I realized in my career that I just sucked at self-promotion. I didn't know how to speak up. I didn't know how to bring attention to my accomplishments. And now having coached so many Asian and South Asian women, I realized it wasn't just me. It is very much a cultural part of our fabric, and not right or wrong. It just is what it is. And so when we understand the differences between collective we-based cultures and individual I-based corporate America culture, we can start to realize why South Asians have such a hard time with self-advocacy in the workplace.
okay, so advocacy in the workplace, what does that mean? And for you specifically, what are some examples of times that you've struggled the most?
Yeah, I mean, I have one example that always, whenever anyone asks me, when was it that I realized I sucked at self-advocacy? It was when I got downsized in 2013. So after grad school, I was working at a very large company, and I was training and coaching a lot of the technologists in the company. So I wasn't in HR. I was actually in the business unit. And so my role disappeared along with other folks that were social and organizational psychologists. Our roles disappeared. But I realized when I was told that I had 5 minutes to gather my belongings. So when you get downsized, if you've ever been downsized, you realize you're often treated like a criminal and you only have a short period of time to grab your things. So I was escorted to my desk to grab my things. And I noticed when I was looking around, everyone that was left in their chairs were part of this clique, this group that I just was like, I didn't get the memo of how to be cool and part of this group, but they were all white men and women. And I just thought, okay, there's something going on and I need to figure out what it is. So I'll never know if it was racial bias or if it was simply that I just sucked at self-advocacy.
So specifically for women and South Asian, for Asian women and South Asian women, what would you say what's the landscape in terms of barriers that they face with upwards mobility?
Right. So whether you are raised in India or Asian, South Asian cultures, or you are raised by parents from those cultures, what happens is, you know, Indian and South Asian cultures are very collective, we-based cultures. And so it's all about group harmony. It's about sharing. It's about the collective sort of goodness of the group. And in corporate America and in North America specifically, it's very I-based, where it's all about yourself, your accomplishments, your achievements. And so there is this disconnect when you come from a we-based culture and you're expected to thrive in an I-based North American corporate culture. And I think a lot of Asians and specifically South Asians, the reason we struggle with that is because, again, we're taught to keep our head down, to do good work, and that our work will speak for itself. And that's not the case. You have to know how to self-advocate with your work and in teams. I believe there's an I in team. You really need to learn how to bring attention to your accomplishments. Otherwise, you will be overseen for promotion. You won't get the raise that you want. Like, there's all these things that happen when you don't know how to speak up and share about your accomplishments.
I have a question, Neelu. You mentioned this in the book, and you mentioned specific examples of just feeling like silenced and feeling like people were speaking over you, specifically men, just kind of like interjecting and making decisions for you or kind of shutting you out. When you experienced this over and over and over and over again, did you feel that it made you feel like you had no self-worth in the workplace, and it make you kind of feel like incompetent? And did you internalize some of those beliefs?
Absolutely. I mean, I remember not only getting downsized numerous times, but I'd also gotten fired a handful of times. And I really realized, I think now in hindsight, as I look back at those experiences, it was truly because I just wasn't good at speaking up. People would take credit for my ideas. Many would take credit for my work, and I didn't know how to, you know, redirect the conversation to say, no, that was actually me. Those were actually my thoughts. I actually contributed XYZ to this. I just sort of let it go. And if you let it go enough, people will, silence will be interpreted as indifference or incompetence in some ways. And I think from Asian and specifically South Asian cultures, we're often taught to be silent, to just let things go, you know? And so it does, there's a disconnect in corporate America for sure.
Yeah. And I think a lot of that also leads to like shame from within, and which I 100% want to explore that like later on in the episode, but I want to definitely bring it up now as well. And I think this really speaks to like South Asian culture as well, and how women are kind of forced to take responsibility for whatever it is that happens to them, whether it's their fault or not. And I wanted to kind of like get your thoughts on that as well. Like, did you often feel ashamed of things that were outside of your control?
Yes. I mean, I would have to then come tell my family, like, hey, I got fired again, or I got downsized again. And there's these repetitive patterns that were going on. So ultimately, I'm the common denominator, right? And so my family's like, what's wrong with you? Why can't you hold down a job? You know, so ultimately, it was like, yes, it's shame brought on you. It's shame brought on the fact that, hey, we educated you. Why aren't you able to do this? This is what you're supposed to do. And it just, there was such a disconnect for me in corporate America as an employee.
I have experienced that myself, and I feel like so many other women have as well. Have you, like, were you able to, like, talk to anyone about it that could kind of relate as you were going through these things and going through these experiences?
You know, earlier in my life as a teenager, actually, I used to have panic attacks. And again, in South Asian culture, we're not open and we don't talk about mental health. And so I didn't have a label, or I didn't know how to identify what I was experiencing. So as I got a little bit older, I realized I have an issue. I have a problem. I need to figure out some remedies, some holistic methods that will help me. And so it sort of led me down the path of yoga, Ayurveda, NLP, right? Like all of these things that have now helped me help hundreds and thousands of people. I needed that for myself and continue to use those resources. But what happened for me is, so what happens is if you constantly get downsized or you're always getting fired, you're not able to self-advocate, it impacts your financial stability, right? Like you're constantly picking up from the last job. And so it definitely impacted my mental health because I was like, I'm seeing all these other South Asians and they are doing great. You know, they're in these careers and they have longevity. And what's going on with me? I don't have that. And so, yes, it absolutely took a toll on my mental health. I definitely had imposter syndrome, specifically as an Indian, because Indians are overachievers, right? Like you look around and there's so many Indians that are doing such great things in the world. And so when you're also one of those Indians that you have the education, you have all the credentials, but you're not doing that well in the world, you're like, what's going on? Why am I constantly getting fired? Why am I constantly getting downsized? And so, yes, it definitely took a toll on my mental health.
So it seems like the module of spirituality directly speaks to creating alignment and purpose-driven living. So it's just like in Be Your Own Cheerleader, you mentioned sectioning off the book into cultural, psychological, and spiritual modules. So as a South Asian woman, I have experienced the impact of fear-based living, and much of it was being reinforced by the collective we-based thinking, meaning trusting the opinions of others over my own. And I've really, really had to work hard on understanding how to incorporate value-based living in all aspects of my own life. Can we explore that a bit further? How does spirituality become a motivating force for women to self-advocate? And did you find there to be a cultural influence for South Asian women to rely on spirituality, for example, incorporating practices and principles of Hinduism, Sikhism, and Islam?
Wow, what an amazing question. I don't even know where to begin with that. But I think, you know, ultimately, the benefit of coming from South Asian cultures is it's these principles, whether it's Ayurveda, whether it's yoga, whether it's if you're Hindu or if you're Sikh or if you're Muslim, right? Like all of these things are in our backyards. It's our family's practice, our ancestors' practice. And so what happens oftentimes is we come to the US or we're raised here and we sort of get further and further away from this ancient wisdom that's there. And so when I was dealing with my mental health issues, I really focused on sort of our ancestral wisdom that's there. And it helped me really understand that, you know, I come from a beautiful culture. I'm going to focus on all of the good things and extract the bad and sort of like take the good. And so I often think of myself as a kid in a candy store. I will take all of the good things out from Ayurveda, from Indian culture, from Sikhism, from Hinduism, from Buddhism, and I will keep what works for me and I will let go of what doesn't work for me. And everyone has their own sort of puzzle or what works for them. So for me, it's absolutely relating to my mental health on a spiritual pathway. And that's really why I divided the book into three sections, because those three sections to me embody who I am, and spirituality plays such a huge role in my daily life.
Yeah, I also felt like it brought some of the magic into your tools and strategies. And like, I also feel like as a Desi woman, at least like having like conversations with my mom, every time I would like tell her like all my like work woes and troubles, she would always just be like, just pray, you know, like pray to God and he'll solve everything. And as much as I like, I think that's, it's kind of corny, and I would just look at her and be like, that's not the solution. I do think that some part of me did kind of rely on believing and having some sort of belief and having some sort of faith in the universe that I was being like guided towards something much greater. And that includes some of the troubles that I face in my career, and that I think a lot of us face. And I think that was a really nice little addition to your book as well. I was just curious. I wanted to know whether there was more of a cultural influence or whether it was just something that you felt, that you personally felt really, really connected to.
I mean, for me, the spiritual aspect, really, I really delved deep into spirituality when I was trying to figure out how to help myself with the panic attacks. So I was consuming so much spiritual text like at a very young age, I was drawn to, you know, Dr. Wayne Dyer, Abraham Hicks. I was reading it even when I didn't even understand it. And so now some of those principles and practices have stayed with me. And I think, you know, going to what your mom said about just pray and things will get better, I think, yeah, my parents have blind faith in sort of religion. And I think of it through the lens of, I want to have that blind faith in my inner guidance system. And so I'm going to work hard to make sure I feel like I can guide myself. And I do have trust in the universe to help along the way. But ultimately, I'm the driver through my inner guidance system.
And that's pretty hard to do, I think. That's really, really hard to do, you know, with the conflicting messaging in our homes and in the workplace. There is just this like sense of confusion because you don't know what to subscribe to. So I find it interesting that you were able to pick and choose between the two. Dhanashree, I feel like even though you're not in corporate America, you probably have also experienced some of this as well in throughout your career. I'm really interested to know like what, you know, what your experience has been like.
Yeah, so I wasn't always a teacher. This was a career transition for me. I was in mechanical engineering. I was working in consumer product design. So I was making, what that means basically for people listening is that whatever products you're seeing on the shelves, I was making them. So in a bunch of different industries, small electronics, packaging, toys, like a bunch of different things. And corporate America was driving me insane. I ended up leaving not because really because of any of the things that we're talking about. I ended up leaving because I just had a higher passion for education. But I definitely experienced these things where like I didn't have the powers of self-advocacy. And actually, there's an interesting part in your book, Nilu, that where you start talking about indications that you put a child in charge. And reading that section, I was like, oh, wow, I see so many parts of my old self in this from like, you know, 5-6 years ago when I was in engineering. But no, I definitely lived through that, like having a lower salary than I'm supposed to have. Like there's just one humiliating instance as an engineer. I was the youngest person in the department. And I was getting paid way less than I should have been getting paid. And I was the only competent person there. And I was the only person in the department that didn't get fired. When I left, it was of my own accord because I was like, I want to go to grad school. And I was getting paid like, okay, I found out like a week before I left, I was talking to a colleague who was at the same level of me, just in a different department, but we had the same roles. Like I was in mechanical, he was electrical, but it was the same job essentially. And I found out that he was making like 50% more than what I was making. And I was like, oh my God, like it is time for me to rage quit. Like I got to get the hell out of here. I was at the point too, where I was just so exhausted. I didn't even want to like pursue this as a fight anymore. I was like, I'm just happy to be leaving at this point. But it's like, I wonder too, like, I guess I really was just like a kid who didn't know how to advocate for myself at the time. And this was one of my first jobs. I was like 23 at the time. I didn't know what to do. So yeah, I mean, that's something I think about a lot.
Yeah. And almost thinking through the lens of if you could do it again, what would you do differently? Like, who would you have spoken to talk openly about, hey, this person makes more money than I do. Like, how do we get the courage to do that? And I think, you know, one thing I've noticed is my parents have blind faith in any authority figures. So whether it's their doctor or whether it's whoever, they don't question anything. And so I think there was a part of me that inherited that. And I think a lot of South Asians inherit that sort of sense of a huge power differential. And there's also research about it, that in Asian cultures, there's a huge power differential where, for example, you can't just walk into, you know, you can't just walk into your boss's office and say hello, or you can't, it's not as informal as it might be in the US. So I wonder, going back to your story, I wonder if, you know, if you could go back in time, who might you have spoken to talk openly about the money differential, or who could you have asked to for support to sort of have a level setting conversation?
You know what? Before I started that job, I actually did ask for more money than they offered. Like I knew to do that at least. So I asked for more money. I got a little bit more. I didn't know how much anyone else was making. I think the best advice I could give myself for back then, because clearly I couldn't talk to the people in charge, was just to find out what other people are making and then make my decision based on that, whether I'm even going to work there or not. Because if they really needed me, they're going to up the offer. And they seem like they really did, frankly.
So it was your own choice to leave. It was something that wasn't making you happy. It wasn't necessarily the reason you left.
I had just gotten into grad school at that point. So I was leaving anyway.
I mean, these are struggles that are real, right? Like, we don't know how to have those money conversations. Often, many of us who are immigrants or parent or children of immigrants, it's like we come from a limited mindset, not an abundant mindset. So even our relationship with money is a challenge to talk about openly.
I feel like a lot of it is very like achievement focused. Like, especially like age 22, 23, it's like, okay, now that you like just get a job and hold it no matter what, but no one really talks about like whether you even want to hold the job down. Like, are you even happy there? Are you even a fit? Is it even something that, you know, drives you? Is it something that, you know, you see yourself doing in the next 5 to 10 years? It's really just like getting the job and it ends there. And I feel like that was like the biggest disconnect for me personally, because I had those questions of like, am I happy here? Like, I was underperforming in my first job ever. I worked in finance for the first like 2.5 years of my career. And I was at a really big bank, and, you know, on the outside, everything looked like not perfect, but it looked good enough. You know, I had my own place. I could pay my own bills. I had a salary, like moved out of state. Like, I looked like a well-functioning, you know, 23-year-old that, you know, had a bachelor's in accounting. But on the inside, it's like, I just was terrified of getting fired because I knew I just wasn't living up to my 100% potential, because I didn't care about the job. But what I cared about was that I had a job that my parents are proud of and that I could say that I was proud of, but I felt zero connection to it. And so I think that's where like my like inquiry began, even though it took me a long time to actually like come to terms with the fact that I was really unhappy and that I wanted to do something different. It took me like years to actually like sit there and be like, well, you know, there's nothing wrong with me. I'm just in the wrong field. And like, I'm not incompetent. I'm not stupid. And I'm not, you know, I'm not a bad employee because I'm only performing to like 60% of like what I'm capable of. I just feel zero connection to what it is that I'm doing. But, but I felt like my conversations, like outside of work with other DCs and like other immigrants, like other people of color, was just kind of like similar. It was like, damn, like, I hate what I do, but like, you know, it pays the bills and like, you got to grind, you know, like I do my passions outside of work. And like, I make sure that like, you know, I have like passion projects on the weekends, or like, I do what I love, like outside of the workplace. And like, it just felt like a lot of us just were so unhappy with what we were doing, but we were just still just like settling for like the, like good enough because it just, you know, it was financially stable, or it was like it sounded good on paper, or it was like the safe and easy way out. And I think that's what kind of kept me like stuck in that bubble of like, okay, like you're fine here. You don't need to like make any drastic moves, instead of just being like, forget this shit. Like, this is not for me. I really wish that it was normalized to actually just like get out of something that is not a good fit for you, like in early stages.
Yeah. And there's like an element of desperation in it too, and everything that you just said. So I don't know. I know like bits and pieces of how it is in the rest of the U.S., but I'm a New York City born Bengali kid. And in New York City, Bengalis, like, we're not seen the way the rest of the country sees like Indians and other South Asians. Like, Bengalis are notoriously the people who do not have the money. Like, we immigrate here and like, we're not doing well, we're struggling. And so like in the beginning, like, sure, I was one of these kids too. And I was surrounded by other Bengalis and other immigrants from other countries who are in a similar ways, similar positions. So it's like, get the job and not just keep it because it looks good or it's good for your marriage prospects or whatever, but keep it because like, hold onto it for dear life, because God damn it, you need that money. Like, what are you going to do without that money? And there is that, like, I'm all about the drastic changes. I mean, I was like, what a hard shift into teaching. But that was, I remember like when I went into teaching, people were kind of like, that's a big salary cut. What are you doing? And I was like, I know, a little bit crazy, right? But listen, I have a living that I'm happy with. Like, I'm able to support myself and then some. Like, I'm good. I know it was a salary cut, but it was worth it for me. But there is like that element of desperation where like people kind of look twice when they're like, wow, you were a whole engineer and like, ooh, you left.
I think it's just, it's very common amongst immigrants just to think about survival versus happiness. Exactly, yeah. I mean, if I say to my parents, I'm not happy with something, they're like, are you kidding? Like, they're paying you this amount. You have this client and they're paying you this amount. I'm like, yeah, but I'm not happy with the work. And they're like, it doesn't register. I mean, I had no business going to Stern. The only reason I went to Stern was because that was the only thing my parents would pay for. And I am not good. I might be the only Indian out there that's not good in math and science. I am much
I'm with you. Okay. I'm with you. Bachelor's in accounting, still not good at it.
Sorry, yeah. I can make up for both of you.
Yeah, seriously. I'm probably glad, Anu, that you and I are like the Indians that are not good in math and science.
Literally the worst.
I absolutely suck at it. And so that's why even when I went to grad school, my dad was like, I don't agree with this. I don't think you should get your master's. I think you should get your MBA. I'm like, but I don't want an MBA and I will suck at it. I want to focus on what I love to do. So even up until that point, there was, you know, a little bit of a disconnect with my folks. They were like, you need to do the things that will bring you the most money. You need to be financially secure. And it did circle around. I am financially secure. I just didn't go the linear path that my parents thought that I needed to go down. And I think that's the plight of many Asians, many South Asian kids.
I want to talk about just like the differences in workplace styles. We kind of talked about that earlier, but like just your general noticings, East collective, we versus West individual. From your professional experience and coaching and like with all your clients, what are some differences, like major differences?
Well, I mean, I think that with the women I've coached and I continue to coach who are Asian or South Asian, it's just self-advocacy we struggle with. So talking about ourselves, our credentials, our accomplishments. And so I just offer a tool that I call like the speedometer in a car, right? There's a we part and there's an I dial. And so you have the awareness to navigate this dial. So if you're in a performance review conversation, that's really where you need to turn up the I. You need to talk about all of your accomplishments, all of your contributions, right? And if you are in a team setting, you're going to be in a we space, which where we are comfortable residing in because that's what we know and what's familiar to us. So one of the tools is just, hey, have the awareness that you are still going to be authentically who you are. You're just navigating this dial. And based on the context and the situation, you're going to turn up or turn down the we or the I based on who's in front of you. So it's always all about know your audience. And for me personally, like as a solopreneur, when I'm on a business development call, I literally have to like say to myself, okay, Neelu, this is all about you. You have to sell yourself. You have to talk about your credentials, your education, your accomplishments. And in my mind, I'm like, I'm going to sound boastful. I'm going to sound like an asshole, but it's not, right? Like you are literally doing what you need to do in order to get this new client. And so if I'm brought into a team or a coaching session, I'm going to use more outcome-based we language, right? So know your context, know your setting. And I just realized that I cursed and I apologize.
It's okay. We cuss here.
Yeah. Okay, good. Yeah.
Yeah. I felt like I really, you mentioned something about like when you were downsized and you looked around and you saw that people just didn't look like you. Mm-hmm. I really struggled with belonging throughout my professional career in so many different organizations. Like not even just like, oh, like no one looks like me because I'm brown and I'm a woman. But I just felt like even the thinking was so different. Like there was just like a lack of like understanding around the fact that like there's really no inclusion here. And like, I felt like I didn't belong in so many workplaces. And so I wouldn't show up as myself like authentically because anytime I did, it would rock the boat. And I feel like there is just, even though like America is this very like compared to South Asian cultures, compared to like Indians, you know, it is more like individual and people have more of a say. I still feel like women cannot do that. You know, like as a woman, for you to like raise something and raise awareness in the workplace, it's still kind of just, it's still very radical as much as it's like accepted now, like especially in like recent years. I still feel like there's still that, like, you know, that notion. A lot of people buy into the notion that like, oh, well, women don't no longer face barriers in the workplace because they're mm-hmm. equals now. Like it's all good now. It's all fine now. And I'm just like, are you like where do you see that? Like, mm-hmm. What do you mean? Like there is a difference between equality and equity. And like, it's the equity part that I just don't see in the workplace. And like, I just wanted your thoughts on that because I'm just like, I don't know how I've like worked in these organizations where like women literally think, oh, well, things are different now. You know, like we have a say now. And like,
did any of those women live through the nightmare of being the only female engineer in a company? Like, I don't think they have, because I could write books on this, on the crazy things I've heard, not even just in the workplace, but even as an undergrad, like in my classes, I was one of five women who graduated and 50 other guys in my major. you know, and the things I heard from those guys too. I do well on a test. It's not because I'm smart. It's because I slept with the professor, who are like my dad's age, by the way. Like, ew. I mean, I'm sorry. Like, oh God, these people do not know what the hell they're talking about. Like, it's still so rampant. And sometimes I really had to sit and wonder, like, did I get this job because I'm qualified at it or because they knew it would be cheaper to pay me?
Oh my God.
Because
yeah.
I'm young and I'm brown that. And I'm a woman.
That. I felt that.
I think there's an intersectional piece, right? Like intersectionality of being a woman and being brown, and then there's, and you're not represented. So I have a client who is, so I coach a lot of people at Google, and I work a lot with tech, in tech. And I have a woman who works at Google who's Muslim, and she says that, so she, there's very few women in her group, but specifically it's very bro culture. So they're always going out for drinks. And she's a Muslim and she doesn't drink. And so it's like constantly feeling like not only does she not belong, but she's not invited to some of those things because they're like, oh, no, she's not going to drink. So she'll feel out of place. So we're not even going to invite her. Right. So you're being excluded because people are making assumptions that you don't even want to socialize because you're not drinking. And so there's all these intersectional components to it. And I think being a woman and being brown, it is definitely isolating in the workplace.
Yeah, and there's just assumptions made about, like, you know, like what type of worker you'll be. And, you know, I feel like I've definitely gotten the job in previous roles. I've gotten the job because there was this, I guess there was this assumption that I would keep my head down and not really question authority, especially when I've taken roles where it's like contract roles, where it's like a mat leave, where it's like someone stepping out for 6 months, 8 months. So we just kind of need you to work hard while they're gone and not really question things. And then I'd be in the role and I'd start pointing out how there's like serious inefficiencies in like processes and like, you know, that like we probably hired the wrong people and like there's probably like leadership, like management sucks here, or like you guys are like rotten to the core. And like I would bring these things up and there would just be this like backlash towards me. Like, why are you questioning us? You know, like you're only here for a short amount of time. Like you're not, your job is really like the messaging was the same. It was like, well, why are you trying to like just challenge the status quo here, you know? And then I would be left wondering, like, if I was a man, would you react this way? Like, would you have reacted this way if I was a man asking you for the same thing, you know? Like, I couldn't help but like wonder that. And I felt like that's been kind of that's been like a thread that I've experienced over and over and over again. And I do feel like corporate culture in America is still like a lot of it is lip service and a lot of it is just like a lot of it is all talk. And as women, we experience feeling like we will be included, but then when we need to be included and we need to be seen, we're rejected. Even though it's like it could be like very like implicit, it could be like very like you feel like the people say, like, you tell me anything you want to, you know, tell me what's on your mind, feel safe, but it's not safe. Like the environment is not safe. It's toxic. And I have seen that like around the board. And I feel like there's, because it's like that lack of, people do not understand that there is a very big difference in equality versus equity. And that's probably what it is. I think, you know, resources that men have, that white women and white men have, you know, people of color do not have those resources. They just don't. And it's the truth. And it's like one of those like awkward, uncomfortable things to like encounter. And I feel like it's coming up even more now in like remote work, you know, you're because we're behind a screen most of the time. So it's even tougher to connect at this point. So
one thing I've noticed, and I don't know if you can relate to this, but I think all of us, so I'm in New York also, it was like we're all on the East Coast. And I noticed even before COVID, many of my clients, I just found myself working with more companies on the West Coast in the Bay Area. And I mentioned I work in tech a lot. I have a lot of tech clients. And so I feel like the companies in the Bay Area, the companies on the West Coast, they're a little bit more focused on belonging and equity and inclusion. And I find that on the East Coast, we're still years behind in terms of the progression.
Oh,
and yeah, because we have like Agreed. Financial services. And I noticed like my clients in the East Coast, I was doing a workshop over COVID and I used the word blessing. And I later got, you know, some some issues about the word blessing. They thought there was too much of a spiritual component to it. Meanwhile, if I was on the West Coast, I could say blessing, I could say gratitude, I could say whatever I wanted to say. So even I think there's a bit of a cultural disconnect from East Coast and West Coast in terms of bringing your full self to work. I feel like there's companies on the West Coast that definitely focus more on equity and belonging than on the East Coast. And I don't know if that's your experience, Anu.
100%. 100%. A lot of the companies that I've worked in are based in the East Coast, and financial services was probably I don't want to say worse, but I felt like there was a lack of understanding and acceptance of equity. There was just no acknowledgement of it. It wasn't even a thing. It was kind of just like, oh, well, you know, there's women here and I have a female manager. So I don't understand what you mean by there's no equity here. You know, it was just kind of like, well, we're here and we're lucky to be here because they've given us a chance. Like, though, that's kind of like what my conversations with other female POC was like in financial services. And then when I left and I was in the tech workspace, I felt like there actually was a little bit more of an understanding. And even in like hiring decisions, it was like, I felt like as a recruiter, the types of conversations I was having was around like, okay, well, we want to have more diversity in leadership, not just like associate level or like analyst level. We want to hire like women of color in leadership roles because we need more women of color in leadership roles. And I did my master's thesis on this actually. This is so interesting, but apparently diversity and mentorship shows that women actually trust men more as mentors than they do women as mentors. And that I found so interesting. Like,
so
especially women,
sad.
Especially women of color, they will actually trust a white man over another woman of color in leadership roles. They will actually open up more to men than women. And that really speaks to how much like there is a lack of trust that we have in these systems. And whether it's true or not, it still exists. Like, and I feel like that's so important to pay attention to. It's like, do we see each other as competition versus do we see each other as someone that can be a mentor, someone that we can trust? And it's really sad. And I feel like I have definitely seen a lot of that, like working in the East Coast for all types of organizations. But I've had clients in the West Coast, and I felt like they were a lot more educated in these matters. And I felt like they were talking about these things. At least there was acknowledgement, there was conversation around it. So I felt more comfortable to actually like show up as myself, you know, but I haven't worked for an organization based in the West Coast. So,
well, you know, what's interesting about that, I have heard the same research and I've read that as well. And I think for the South Asian women listeners, I think my advice would be like to have a portfolio of mentors. So I personally have a tall white male person that I go to for pricing, because he often tells me I'm undervaluing my services. So to bounce off money with him is really beneficial. But then I have a woman mentor who's white for X. And then I have another Asian, South Asian mentor. You know what I mean? So it's like diversify your mentor portfolio based on what you need assistance with. So if it's pricing, it's probably really helpful to have a tall white man to talk to about pricing. Because they are going to level set and say you are undercharging. You want to find an ally who can help you sort of figure that out.
That's so interesting.
Yeah, that's good advice. So can we get a little bit into some of the techniques that you've talked about in the book in terms of like self-advocacy? Yeah.
I mean, so as I was talking about the we and the I dial, that's something that I use daily, right? Knowing before I get on a call, before I get on a Zoom, like, do I need to talk more about myself or is it about sort of the team, the goals of the team? So navigating that we and I dial is a strategy I often coach my Asians and South Asian women that I work with. The other thing I think is, you know, and I don't know if you can relate to this, but I remember when I was little and I got a 95 on a test, my parents' first response was, what happened to that 5? Right? Mm-hmm. What happened to the other 5? Not like, great job, you did a great job, you still got an A, but it was like, hey, what happened to that other 5? And so when you grow up with that sort of striving for perfectionism, it really could lead to a mental health breakdown. And so one of the things that I coach my Asian and South Asian women on is celebrating small wins, because it's not something that's part of our culture to do. We are looking at this long journey and saying, okay, we finished our grad school, or we finished our PhD, or we finished this, and now we can celebrate. But I actually encourage us to celebrate those small wins, because you know, our parents don't have the worldview to say, hey, we're really proud of you. They might show it in actions. They won't show it in verbal affirmation. That's just not part of our cultural makeup. So it's like we have to do that for ourselves. And I think when we get in the habit of giving ourselves a pat on the back, it helps us be our own cheerleaders in the workplace.
This kind of reminds me of a portion, well, several portions in your book where you talk about neuro-linguistic programming. Okay, I just want to read a quote from the book. Okay, it says, in the field of neuro-linguistic programming, NLP, there is a basic premise that every behavior has a positive intention. Even a behavior that has negative consequences, feeling bad or uneasy, has a positive intention. For example, if you have an inner critical voice about being an imposter in your job, the positive intention could be a desire to keep striving for excellence or to provide motivation to continue working at proving your value in the organization. So I love this. I want to talk about this. How do we shift from I'm horrible at this to I just want to get better at this?
I think it all starts, and this is a premise of NLP, is the questions we ask ourselves, right? So, or the way we even speak to ourselves. So the way we speak to ourselves is going to impact the way we speak with others. So in a situation where you are feeling like an imposter, instead of saying, you know, why can't I get this? You're blaming yourself, you might want to ask, who can I ask for help, right? So it's called problem or outcome frame questions. And oftentimes that inner critic is using problem frame questions where it's very blaming. And it's and oftentimes it's not even our voice. It could be the voice of a critical parent. It could be the voice of our culture in a way, right? And so the idea is that we want to shift into outcome focused questions, which are more around, you know, who can I ask to for assistance? More around sort of the positive outcome that can come from the questions that we ask ourselves.
When I was first starting out in human resources, I felt like I didn't belong because I felt like I wanted to help people, but how could I help people when I struggled to help myself? So I felt this like imposter syndrome, especially as like a recruiter, like I was helping people get into roles that they wanted. And I felt like I was on the phone with people and I wanted to help them. And I was trying to figure out if they were a good fit for open positions. And then each time I would put the phone down, I'd start questioning myself, like, who are you to make this decision? You know, who are you to try to help someone when you struggle so much yourself? And there was this critical like voice that I was struggling with in my early years as a recruiter and as an HR professional, because the whole purpose of like being of service to someone is to help them, you know, throughout their career journey. But then I would turn around and kind of like look at myself as like, well, you struggle so much yourself. How can you're no expert at this? You're not someone who's conquered this yourself. So how can you help someone else? You know, I really struggle with that self-judgment. And I feel like a lot of it is cultural too, because I would get that question even in the home, where my mom would be like, why are you focusing on other people why are you focusing on this when like you can't even get this right? And it would just be this like comparison thing. And so I had to like really, really, really work on learning that like that behavior and that thought process. And I was finally able to like get to the root of that through like years of therapy. And now I have to journal. Like I have to sit there and like write down like, you know, like why I'm judging myself before I allow myself to do something good for someone else. And that self-worth piece would come up a lot, and I would feel really overwhelmed by it. And I would kind of like look at the problem like in from like a very big picture, instead of breaking it down into like little, you know, like manageable, like, you know, steps that I could take. And I love that like you focus on like celebrating your small wins, because I think that a lot of that gets so overlooked in our culture. Like we're not even allowed to like celebrate like one small step that we've taken towards, you know, a journey that might take a while, you know, or a lifelong journey even.
Can I read another quote?
Oh, yes.
Oh, can no, I do your thing?
Yeah, yeah. So Anu, the other thing when you were talking made me think, you know, we also come from a very superstitious culture, right? So it's like, mm-hmm. if you celebrate too quickly, it's like that might impact the outcome. Exactly.
Yeah, my God. Yeah.
Right? We all have been there, like Gandhi Neza, right? Like we all know this. And so that impacts, if you think about it, it does impact our inability to celebrate. because yeah. we were told don't celebrate too quickly. You haven't finished your.
It'll be taken away from you.
Exactly. Yeah. So if you think about that, that's embedded in our DNA. And so, of course, yeah. it's going to impact our inability to be able to celebrate small wins.
That's deep.
Yeah.
I love that you just mentioned Nuzzer. I love that.
Yeah. Well, it's funny. I actually hadn't really tied it to that until I know your story, which made me think when you said what your mom told you, it's like you can't, you know, what you're, I think it made me think of like the superstitious element of our culture as well. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah. That's something I don't think I'll ever let go of.
But then according to NLP, it's serving you in some way. Otherwise we wouldn't be holding on to it. So what is it giving you?
Yeah. Yeah. Thunder Tree, you had something to add.
Yes.
Oh yeah. I had a quote that I highlight. I have a lot of quotes that I highlighted, but what you were talking about just reminded me of this. And so I wanted to read it because there's a reason I highlighted it. Okay. So it says, practice makes permanent. According to author Tara Lazar, success is part of the word succession, which means to come after or follow after. We can define success as a succession of small events. Patting yourself on the back, giving yourself credit, and feeling proud of yourself is a muscle. And with our cultural roots, it is not a well-developed one. Celebrating small successes is a great way to build the muscle of self-promotion. Ultimately, once you make this a regular practice, it will be easier to do. Let's start practicing how to acknowledge and celebrate small or large successes and learn to pat yourself on the back. And then this is followed by a deliberate practice of how to do this, sit down and be mindful of the successes that you are celebrating.
Yeah, I think it's something that we just don't, it's not, again, it's not a well-developed muscle. We were taught not to celebrate, right? We have this superstitious culture. We have sort of this, again, it's a comparison too. It's like, okay, your cousin's doing this, so you should be doing this, right? So there's so many underpinnings as to why it's challenging for us to celebrate small wins.
Yeah, you know, there are so many people that I could be compared to, but also there are a lot of people who could use me to compare their kids to. I try to remember
my God.
That too.
Thank
That's
God you said that.
That's a great reframe, actually. That is such a great reframe and a very healthy one because it allows
maybe
you
I'm
to
Maybe I'm not
feel...
a doctor, but I have two master's degrees. I'm sure there's people out there who don't like that about me because their parents are talking about it.
Also, you have the courage to do what you love, which I think is the highest form of success. Personally.
Oh, I don't think any brown parent is impressed by that.
They're not impressed by it. No, but like I definitely want to talk about like success and like what that means in Desi culture versus like American culture. And I don't think that there is that much of an overlap because both lead to achievement. Like they're both very achievement focused cultures, but for I guess similar reasons, you know, like survival is a big one for Desis, you know, survival, like coming to this country and having nothing. And my parents had nothing when they came here. And so it was very important for them to survive and to build a legacy for their children so that we didn't have to work as hard. But I always counter that. And when I have conversations with my parents, I always tell them, you know, we struggle in a different way. We don't struggle the way that you struggled when you came here. And so I will never understand what you went through having to come here with nothing and build yourself from the ground up. So I have privilege in that way. But what you don't understand is that we struggle to find ourselves in a society that was so different from yours and from what you taught us at home. And that in itself is like something that we have to live with for the rest of our lives, you know, like identity and like belonging. And how do we define success in our own terms when we don't know what it is, you know, when it can be so different from what our parents taught us. And I know my parents are just like flabbergasted when I talk about this with them. But I think deep down they understand that it's something that they don't understand.
So you have talked about, we have talked a lot about self-advocacy. What I like about the work that you do is that you not only talk about self-advocacy, but also actually how to become a leader. What a big shift from not knowing how to advocate for yourself to becoming a leader. Can you, I don't know if this is possible to do, but can you kind of just highlight a couple of strategies that we can expect to see in your book in terms of actually becoming a leader?
In terms of becoming a cheerleader for yourself?
Yes.
Yep. Yeah. So there's a chapter dedicated to interruption shields, which is really words or phrases that we can use.
Oh, yes. I'm so glad you brought that up. I meant to bring that up. Yes, yes, yes. I love it.
It's words or phrases used to jump back into conversations, or if you need to interrupt to get your point across. So these words or phrases are what feel comfortable for you. So one I use a lot is, if I may, can we circle back to, right? Like, you really want to start using these and get comfortable using them. And so I truly believe the way we are in one situation is how we will be in another situation. So if it feels uncomfortable to do this at work, practice at home. Like, practice with your partners, practice with your siblings, practice with whoever, your friends. The idea is that you want to start using these interruption shields more and more, so people don't take credit for your work, so your ideas don't get overlooked, so you can interrupt when you need to interrupt. And if you are interrupted, which happens a lot for women, and especially South Asian women, you know then how to jump back into the conversation. So there's a whole chapter dedicated to that. And the idea is, like, you come up with the phrases that feel comfortable for you. So in financial services, they may sound more formal than if you're in tech. Or, you know, at school, as a school teacher, it may look, sound very different than what Anu and I deal with in corporate America. So that's a strategy. Also, you know, navigating that we and the I dial is a strategy that I love to just bring to the surface and bring the awareness that you have the ability to dance between the we and the I on a daily basis, based on your context, based on the audience and who's in front of you. And then the third strategy I would say is really truly celebrate those small wins, because we are so unused to doing that. We are so unskilled in doing that, that we need to start practicing. And I think the ultimate thing I want to share is, this is not that, you know, there's such beautiful things that come from our culture. So I don't want to discount those. And I don't want to say the I way is the right way and the we way is the wrong way. I mean, there are some beautiful things that come from we collective cultures. The idea is that we want to start navigating and dancing between the two. And I think there's a whole host of strategies in my book that allow us to dance between the we and the I on a daily basis.
Can you tell us a bit more about your own inner cheerleader? How did you learn to tap into her?
Yeah, that's a great question. How did I learn to tap into my own inner cheerleader? I think it starts with the dialogue, and the way you speak to yourself is the way you speak to others. So one strategy I use a lot is, if I have a hard time speaking about the accomplishments, I speak to myself in third person. So I will say, Nilu did this. Nilu wrote a book. Nilu went to NYU. Nilu went to Columbia. And until you get comfortable in third person, you can start then integrating into first person. Right? Another thing that I used to do is, I would pretend I was my best friend, because I would never speak to my best friend the way I was speaking to myself. Right? Like, the things that I was saying to myself, I would never say to a friend. So oftentimes that was a way that I would tap into being my own cheerleader, is I would pretend I was my best friend and I would talk to my best friend. And when you talk to your best friend, you talk to your best friend with compassion and love. And that's really what we need for ourselves.
And I think another component of this, which was a lovely dichotomy that you presented in your book, was the judger mindset versus the learner mindset. Can you expand on that a little bit for our listeners?
Yeah, I mean, it comes from Marilee Adams' work on Change Your Questions, Change Your Life. And it's a book that I highly recommend. But essentially, again, it comes to the questions we ask ourselves. So if we are more outcome framed questions using the NLP approach, or problem framed, that's going to impact whether we are in a learner or a judger mindset. So if we're blaming ourselves, like, whose fault is it? Why did I get this wrong? And you're in a very blaming place, that's sort of in the judger mindset, versus just shifting over to asking different questions, like, how can I get the support I need? What other certifications or professional development do I need to get, right? Like, you're in much more a learning mindset just based on the questions you ask yourselves and the way you speak to yourself. So that is definitely a strategy to be your own inner cheerleader, is change the questions that you ask yourself.
There are at least 15 other things that I highlighted here. But you know what? I think maybe let's not give the whole book away. But is there anything else? Well, first, Anu, were there any other questions that you wanted to cover before we start to wrap this up?
Yeah, I definitely had some questions. Or we can distill it down to one question on legacy. We always like to end our episodes with a nice legacy question. So I'll present that. What's your advice to South Asian women learning how to show up for themselves while simultaneously unlearning the beliefs and behaviors that keep them feeling small?
Practice, practice, practice. So practice at home, practice with your friends. Self-advocacy is not just going to be a miracle thing you do easily at work if you're not practicing in other situations. So I think if you can practice with your partner, even saying, hey, I don't want to eat Thai food, I want to eat pizza. That's actually self-advocacy too, right? Like most of us South Asians, the behavior that was modeled to us was to just go with the flow, to not rock the boat. So I don't know what the dynamic was in your home, but my mom basically did whatever my dad wanted to do. And so I grew up thinking that I can't actually say what I want to do. I just have to keep group harmony. And so I would tell all the South Asian women out there to practice in every situation. When you feel like you want to do something, practice. It doesn't have to just be at work. It could be with your husband. It could be with your wife. It could be with your partner.
Yeah, the way I see it is agreeing with stuff feels like the safe option, but actually it's the unsafe option in the long run.
Especially if it's not what you want to do. Especially if you're doing it just because you're like, okay, I'll just go along with this because I don't want to rock the boat.
Yeah, it breeds resentment, I think. Definitely breeds resentment. And then resentment becomes this like this acceptable emotion that you continuously feel. But then, you know, it stays in your body physically.
And then you think the world owes you something, but the world was here first.
That's going to get the aunties mad. It's true.
I think we've covered a lot. And I think for all of my South Asian sisters out there, I wish you a journey of becoming your own cheerleader. I think we really need to do that because it's just something that's such a foreign concept to us.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for being here. Nilu, how can we find you? How can we find your book and anything else related to your work?
Yeah, so on my website, nilucor.com, I'm very active on LinkedIn. Under my name, also Instagram, and you can find my book on Amazon and Barnes & Nobles and most other places you can find books.
Amazing. Okay, I will list all of that stuff and link all of it in the episode description. And thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you so much. This was wonderful.
Thank you, Neil. This is awesome.
That is the end of our episode, bonus. We hope you enjoyed this, and thank you so much for joining us on this journey. If you'd like to reach out to us, we can be found on Instagram and Facebook at The Desi Condition. You can also email us at thedesicondition@gmail.com or visit our two websites, tdcpodcast.com and, of course, our Desi Creatives directory at desicollaborative.co. Stay safe, stay warm, make good choices, and we'll talk to you next time.